All right, it is time for another episode of The Fifth Estate. My name is Jay Caruso. I'm here with my co-host, Mr. Neil Dewing. How are you?
Hey, how about you?
I'm doing pretty well,
Glad to hear that.
Yeah. So, hey, as always, as we do when we start the show, we always ask everybody, you know, if you like what you listen to, you like what you hear, please go and subscribe to the show, leave us a rating, leave us a review. It always helps with the iTunes people. They like to see that stuff.
It does, and it helps us to develop and improve as podcasters. So, you know, we pretty much are completely reliant on feedback from you fine people who are listening to the program. So don't be shy.
Absolutely. All right, so on the last episode, we talked journalism with Betsy Woodruff, which was great.
We did.
And now we're going to talk about writing kind of in general. And I mean, hey, what better way to discuss writing than to have one of the best in the business on our show?
So I can't think of a better way to do it. And, you know, Jay, you and I have both dabbled in writing for an audience. And it's not always the most glamorous job, but it has its rewards.
Certainly does.
Certainly does. But it helps to know what you're doing. So. We have asked Kevin Williamson of National Review to join us on the program today. Kevin, how are you?
Hey, you know, Woodruff there got her start actually in the program I direct at the William F. Buckley Institute, but in spite of my bad influence, she seems to have turned out pretty well.
She did turn out pretty well. Yeah, she mentioned the William F. Buckley Fellowship that she was a part of, and we had a great conversation. So
yeah, she's one of my favorites. She's terrific.
Same here. So we wanted to talk to you kind of more generally about just writing, you know, how one becomes a writer, how one pays the bills writing, that sort of thing. And so we wanted to just sort of start with your background, you know. Have you always worked as a writer or
yeah, kind of. You know, it's funny the way you said that, the becoming a writer thing versus writing, which are two very, very different sorts of things, especially when you're in college, but also sometimes later in life, you meet people who say that they want to be writers. Mm-hmm. What they mean is that they want to go do book signings and have maybe lunch with their agent and have this very intense social life that they imagine that's what being a writer means, like, you know, wearing a black turtleneck and smoking Gauloises and having conversations about Baudrillard and that sort of thing. What you actually do, of course, is sit in an empty room by yourself for many hours a day and write. It's a very kind of lonely occupation. Yeah, I can tell you a little bit how I got into it.
Please.
Depends on how far back you want to go. I can't remember articles that I wrote 6 months ago when people asked me about them, but I have a very strangely complete memory of my childhood, things going back to when I was well under a year old. And I can remember being prelingual and not knowing words for things, not being able to communicate and being very, very frustrated by that. It's one of the worst memories of my childhood, of being, you know, trying to communicate, not being able to. I have no idea why I remember that era in my life. Most people don't, but I remember it really pretty well. I can remember a specific conversation I had with my mother when I must have been not more than a year old, or certainly under two, where she was trying to figure out what I wanted for lunch, and I couldn't explain it to her, and I was very, very upset by this. Not so much because I was concerned about what sort of sandwich I was going to get, but just the idea. I thought there was something wrong, that I didn't know words for things. I started to really, you know, I enjoyed writing from an early period of my life. I was always sort of what's known as a graphomane, I guess. I do write kind of compulsively and obsessively. And I've done so since a young age. When I was in seventh grade, I had a biology teacher by the name of Sheila Cagle. Mrs. Cagle is an interesting character because she was this very pretty, sexy, blonde, blue-eyed, 22-year-old Texas Tech cheerleader, just kind of out of school in her first job teaching seventh grade in Lubbock, Texas. Uh-huh. And among other things, she had to teach us sex ed. That was part of the class. So we all paid rapt attention, as you might imagine.
Understandably, yes.
Bagel's class. But she gave us what I thought was a really, you know, sort of stupid and disappointingly stupid assignment. Oh, we had to go collect some bugs or something and then write a report about bug collecting. And Lubbock isn't really all that great in terms of, you know, fauna. It's a big grassy desert. We kind of have gnats and black flies and not much that's really interesting, no scorpions or anything cool like that. So I went and did this very boring assignment, and I started to write it up, and I was just bored to tears with it. And the only way I could do this and get it done was I wrote sort of a comic version of a lab report or a field report for a seventh grade biology class. It was intended as a sort of Ernest Hemingway parody. You know, he wrote those hunting stories that I was a fan of. And in retrospect, I look back at it, it's not really a very good Hemingway parody. There are way too many adjectives, which is what Rich Lowry tells me all the time, way too many adjectives. So things haven't changed all that much. The next year, I had a very, very good English teacher by the name of Linda Stogner, who entered an essay I wrote into a contest of some sort, which ended up with that being published in a Houghton Mifflin grammar textbook for eighth graders. This was, you know, the early 80s, the middle 80s, when the idea of relevancy was very important to people, and they thought that putting student writing into textbooks would make people, students, connect with that better, which in retrospect seems to me absurd. But so that was my first real publication. In payment for that, I received, gosh, you're sitting right here in front of me on my desk, I have this very nice matched set. It's an American Heritage Dictionary and a thesaurus, you know, the leather bound. I have many leather bound with my name in Boston gold on the front. The nerdiest, of course, possession ever. In the dictionary, there's an essay about dictionaries by William F. Buckley, whose existence I was just sort of vaguely familiar with at that point in life. And so I started reading his stuff after reading that in the dictionary. And kind of have been doing it ever since. I mean,
this was in the eighth grade?
Temporarily, yeah. So someone, some great benefactor, saw to it that my library at my junior high, at J.T. Hutchison Junior High in Lubbock, Texas, actually got national review. So I was able to go down there and read the magazine. And the public library there got it too, although that was about 7 miles from my house. That was kind of a long walk. But so, yeah, I started reading National Review. The idea of actually writing for a living started to occur to me right around the same time, actually. Before that, I thought I was going to be a scientist. But I kind of hit that math wall that you hit around your middle to early teen years.
Yes.
Just clear to everyone except me that I wasn't going to do this. It finally became clear later in college when one of my econ professors explained to me why I was not going to be an economics major. Even though I was technically an economics major at the time, I simply didn't have the mathematical capability for it. So I wrote for my high school newspaper, the Westerner World. In fact, I just had lunch today with a fellow who was the president of my senior class in high school, our student council president, who's a big-time attorney these days. And I wrote an editorial calling for his impeachment and removal from office. And because he was on the staff, of course, I made him proofread it. He took it all in good humor and wrote a pretty good headline for it. So, life never really changed all that much for me. I've been doing basically the same thing ever since. For a big period of my career, for about nearly 20 years, I guess, I wrote columns and things, although that wasn't really what I did for a living. I was a newspaper editor. I was mostly in management and production. So I was editor-in-chief of three newspapers over the years, including one that I started in Philadelphia, and then two small-town newspapers.
Oh, wow.
And it wasn't really until I was in my late 30s that I started writing for National Review and doing opinion stuff full-time. I'd written columns, of course, when I was editor of the newspapers, because that's a privilege that you get to accord yourself as editor, but it was never really the main part of my job. I was mostly a management guy.
That's fascinating. So you actually started a newspaper in Philadelphia.
Yeah, because I'm a natural businessman and entrepreneur, and how could you go wrong starting a daily newspaper, an afternoon broadsheet, no less?
Oh, wow.
In Philadelphia as a sort of infamous right winger in the year 2004, whenever I did that.
Oh,
surprisingly, wow. The newspaper actually lasted about 5 years, although I was not involved after the first couple of years.
That's a good run.
Yeah, we resurrected the old Philadelphia Bulletin. So mm-hmm. The Bulletin was a beloved newspaper. It had been an afternoon newspaper for a long time. And my business partner and I resurrected that. He had, sometime before we met, acquired the intellectual property and the right to use the name and all that. And we thought, and this is true, that Philadelphia didn't actually have a good newspaper. I mean, the Inquirer is a terrible newspaper. And if you went into, Starbucks, things like that around Philadelphia, all the kind of upper middle class people in Philly at the time you would see were reading, but they would read the New York Times. And of course, they were looking for, the cultural coverage, the book review, the international news, some of that kind of stuff. So our idea was to bring them something like that, then also with the local Philadelphia stuff in it. And it was a beautiful newspaper. We did it like a sort of old-fashioned 1940s newspaper with the three-deck headlines and all that fun stuff. So it was kind of retro. It was a really nicely done thing. It was and it was a fine paper, but it was just a terrible business model. And obviously not the time to be starting a daily newspaper.
Timing is everything. I want to back up a second because dropped a word a little while ago about a compulsive need to write. What was that word?
Graphomane.
Graphomane.
Yeah, so people who write compulsively, there's an old word for it. It's sort of a 19th century thing, which is graphomane.
I love antique words, obsolete English. It's something I enjoy,
Yeah, I didn't end up in National Review by accident. In fact, I applied for a job there when I was in high school.
Really?
Yeah, I was trying to decide whether to go to UT or go to Yale. And Yale was $25,000 a year, and that was considerably more than my household income at the time. So I didn't understand how that kind of stuff worked. Mm-hmm. I didn't know people who'd gone to college or anything like that. I didn't really understand how financial aid worked. In retrospect, I suppose I could have gone to Yale for free. But so I was trying to figure out how to come up with the money to do that because I really wanted to go to Yale. So I sent Bill Buckley a letter and informing him that I was, in fact, the editor of the Lubbock High School newspaper and a longtime National Review reader. So I got a very nice letter back from him and then one from John O'Sullivan later. Dear Mr. Williamson, not currently in need of your services, but future thing. So I brought that up with him, actually, years later. And it turns out, I didn't know this, but the Buckleys have a long connection to the University of Texas, where I ended up going. His father,
he was an oil man.
Senior. Was the first editor of the UT yearbook back in the day, the Cactus, as it's known. And they also donated the land and the house, what became the first Catholic Student Center there at the University of Texas.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, he thought that I had made an okay choice, even though it wasn't quite Yale.
Sure, sure. But the idea that this compulsive need to write, now, how does that kind of manifest? Like you're just constantly writing out your thoughts? You're constantly having ideas for columns and that sort of thing? Or...
Sort of. I mean, the sort of daily grind of internet journalism is a little different. And especially a year like this, because it's an election year, and elections are really not the thing that interests me most in the world. So I'm always writing something about something. It doesn't always fit nicely into what I'm actually expected to do for a living. But I try to make that happen as much as I can, too. But I publish a lot, I probably publish, several hundred thousand words a year, in the high hundred thousands, but I probably actually write two or three times that much.
Mm-hmm. Oh, interesting.
So, I talk about this with Charlie Cook a lot, because Charles is the opposite. Writing for him is a real labor. He's a married guy with a kid and, he likes to play music and be around people and he's a very sociable kind of guy. And so locking himself off in a room by himself to write is difficult for him. It's a real, it's work for Charles. For me, it's just a miracle that I get paid to do it and I don't have to do anything that resembles honest labor.
Now you, there's an interesting story about you. You were, you're a theater critic as well. And story that you, this kind of like iconic story about you where you grabbed some woman's cell phone and kind of tossed it.
Fun thing. Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that one.
Lady was being really obnoxious during a play in which the seating quarters were very close and, on her phone all the way through. And I'd spoken to her about it a few times. You know, when you have a bright screen in a dark room, it's distracting, of course. And she just was one of these, pile of trash people who wasn't going to listen. And, frankly, myself, I'm pretty laid back. It takes a lot to really push my buttons, but it was really bothering my date. And, I do have maybe some surviving atavistic sense of chivalry about that sort of thing. So after having exhausted all the ordinary options of complaining to the management and even pulling a, do you know who I am? I'm the theater critic for the New Criterion, a magazine that you've never heard of. But, I took her phone away and I threw it out the door of the theater.
Oh, out the door of the theater.
There's a curtain and sort of a passage where you would go out if you were leaving the theater. It wasn't like actually out into the parking lot, but I threw it out that door or the vestibule. And I don't think she ever actually recovered her phone. But it was funny for months, and still occasionally I would get letters and emails and stuff from Broadway producers saying, "Well, you work at National Review, so please don't tell anyone I had anything nice to say about you. But I'd like to offer you free tickets for the rest of your life to all my and, that kind of stuff." So some other people, Benedict Cumberbatch and a few other people have taken this up in a way that's much more effective than I can because they're actual performers on the stage. And who is the woman famous for being in A Little Night Music? Blank Manor. Bernadette Peters just absolutely threw a fit with somebody about a year ago on that, where she stopped a show.
Oh wow.
And she just lectured the person from the stage.
Oh man.
So it's just really, really bad manners. Bad manners that aren't just neglectful, which you kind of resent, but you can live with when people are just sort of stupid and don't notice, but bordering on hostility. You know, when they go up there and they make the announcement and say, "Look, this is a really rude thing to do. It's distracting to people, distracting to the performers, your fellow audience members, who, this is Broadway shows we're talking about. So, if you're two people there seeing a show, you may have spent $800. These tickets aren't necessarily cheap." And, someone needs to do something about that more than me. But I just happened to do it on a night that it was a critic's viewing. So like every theater critic in the world was at this show because it was a very popular show. And so there were accounts of it the next day, basically in every English newspaper in the world. In London, Australia, it was in Variety and, Playbill and all that stuff. So I was infamous there for a minute for throwing a temper tantrum.
So you have a varied, varied background in terms of what you've done. Obviously, I'm sure we could put Bill Buckley on the list, but other writers that you know of that inspired you, that are, you still inspire you, people that you read that, kind of keep your juices flowing. Is there anybody in particular?
Well, it's funny. One of the great things about working at National Review, of course, is I get to work with a lot of those people who I'd, grown up with and read for years and loved, Rick Brookhiser and Jane Orlinger and Jonah Goldberg and people like that. But then I also, you have these occasional social occasions, especially in the kind of conservative world where it's socially a pretty small world, where I've been a really bad fanboy on a couple of occasions. I happened to be in an event with PJ O'Rourke one time, and I just was, a little bit starstruck because I love PJ O'Rourke so much. And then a couple of years ago at the annual Buckley dinner where we were honoring some supporters of the magazine, I got to meet Tom Wolfe, who was one of the reasons I wanted to become a writer when I was a kid. Uh-huh. I'd come across the Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test when I was young. I just liked the title. I saw it at a garage sale, picked it up. I was just blown away. And then I, in my weird, obsessive, completist way, just, read everything he ever wrote afterward. And I had to stop myself from, kind of squealing when I met him.
we've all kind of been there at these little conservative gatherings, so don't feel too bad. And I think Tom Wolf pretty much justified for any sort of squealing. So how did you sort of develop your style of writing? I mean, you have a very, you know, a really great voice. I think, Jay, you would probably agree that, you know, you're one of our favorites to read because you come across like very clearly, like you can convey, you know, just withering contempt, but you can also
that seems to be what I'm known for.
You can also do some pretty heartfelt stuff, you know, and you can speak with experience and wisdom as well. And so, you know, does that style come naturally for you? Do you have to work at it? Do you consciously emulate some of your favorite writers, or how does that work?
Well, like a lot of conservatives and conservative writers, you know, I kind of imitated Bill Buckley when I was really young.
Sure.
By which I mean I tried to use, you know, fancy words and Latin, mm-hmm. and complex elocution and that sort of thing. Although if you go back and read Bill, that's actually not how he writes at all. I mean, he has the occasional unusual word or something, but his style actually is a lot simpler than that. It's closer to the way Jay writes, I think, than the way I write. Jay has got this wonderful style that doesn't feel like a style. Mm-hmm. Ramesh is the same way, where their prose is actually really very carefully constructed, but it doesn't feel like it. Whereas my print stuff particularly has what some people would criticize, I think, as writing that feels too much like capital W writing, you know, like look at me go sort of thing. And that's conscious too. You know, the people I've always admired and enjoyed reading have been not just Bill, but then, you know, Tom Wolfe, Hunter Thompson particularly, and David Foster Wallace, who are all these writers who, you know, bring some fireworks to what they do. And I think that's kind of, it's useful if you can do it. You know, I mean, part of writing is being entertaining. It's not just conveying information, even in journalism. You want to be good company.
Right.
You know, people are inviting you into their homes or into their coffee for whatever period of time they spend with you. And so it's incumbent upon you, I think, to try to make it pleasurable. And I have a hard time writing in a way that I don't enjoy reading. So I write stuff that I like. I like stuff that when I read it back to myself, that it makes me feel good, that I would enjoy having read that sentence. It makes me happy to have written it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I do some kind of stunt stuff, obviously, where, you know, in the print pieces, especially, I have these 115 word opening sentences with 19 dependent clauses and all that kind of stuff. And
yeah.
And the editors at National Review do make fun of me for that from time to time.
Well, I was going to say, as an editor yourself, a former editor yourself, I'm sure you're familiar with the phrase like "kill your darlings," right?
Yeah.
Do you have a certain amnesty for your darlings with your editors?
Mine pretty well let me get away with stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Every now and then, if they think it's unclear, they'll pull something out, but that's actually not how we edit there, which maybe I'll get into in a second. National Review is a lot more about trying to bring high intellectual standards to things. So I get criticized by my editor sometimes, and the things that they ask me to rewrite is when they think I'm being unfair to somebody or when I'm making an argument that's not really all that rigorous or that well thought out, which happens from time to time. I know you find that difficult to believe. not so much about the language and that sort of thing. You know, Mike Batemra, who's our literary editor, who is kind of a bastard in a lot of ways, although I like him very much. I turned in a piece a year or so ago that was just a very straightforward account of something for one reason or another. It hadn't struck me as a subject that was good for humor or anything, so I'd written it in a very, very straight kind of way, and his remarks on it when they came back were, "Don't worry, even Tom Wolfe doesn't try to write like Tom Wolfe all the time."
Oh man!
All right.
Yeah,
that's fair. But so they kind of let me get away with the prose stuff for the most part, especially you know, I do a lot of these long reported pieces where I go somewhere and I try to write about, you know, this particular world, whether it's, you know, heroin addicts or poverty in Appalachia or crime in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you're doing something that's a little more, for lack of a better word, literary, like that, I get away with a bit more.
Those were fantastic
fantastic. Then when you're writing, you know, an 850 word daily, here's my opinion about the headlines kind of stuff, which those are good things to write to you.
But doing those sorts of pieces now, do you have kind of a set routine, or do you get to kind of do all sorts of different stuff? You get to go on assignment, and that's. But
yeah,
I'm
super, super lucky. National Review is an unusual institution in that, you know, it loses money, and everyone's okay with that. Everyone sort of understands what National Review is around to do. So I never get any pressure from my editor, or from Rich, or from the publisher, or anyone else to, you know, do things that are commercial or going to drive clicks, or to, you know, be nice to this guy because he's a friend and associated with some donor, and don't go right after this guy. I never get any of that kind of stuff. And so Rich, a couple of years ago, when I went from being an editor to just writing full time, just very, very kindly gave me the best job in journalism, which is I basically just get up every day and I write about what I want to write about. If I want to go somewhere to write about something, I've pretty well got carte blanche to do it. You know, we fly coach at National Review. I don't get to travel maybe the way I prefer to all the time. But, you know, if I need to go to Spain to write about something, I go to Spain to write about something. If I need to go to Muleshoe, Texas to write about something, I get in the car and I go to Muleshoe. So I travel a bit, probably not as much as I should. The last couple of months I've been doing more in the way of more conventional daily political commentary, which, you know, come to think of it, I probably shouldn't. We've got a lot of people who are just a lot better at that than I am. You know, Rich, and not just to, you know, praise my boss here, but writes one of the best kind of, you know, here is a newspaper column length piece on what's going on in politics right now, and an interesting insight on it that you haven't got anywhere else. You know, he's really good at writing that sort of column. Mm-hmm. Ramesh is really good at writing that sort of stuff. Joan is really good at writing that sort of stuff. I'm just a little not as good at that. What I'm good at is going and spending a week somewhere and figure out what's going on and interviewing hookers and homeless people and politicians and whoever else happens to come across my path. And, do that. I mean, an example of that is just a couple of years ago, we covered both of the conventions. This would have been 2012, I guess. And in Charlotte, which is where the Democratic convention was, of course, National Review was put up in the worst hotel in Charlotte because the parties organized the conventions and they hate us. So we were in this place. There were literally, you know, crack vials in the parking lot and hookers working on and that sort of stuff. So everyone else ended up writing, you know, a piece about the convention. I wrote a piece about, you know, hookers and drug addicts in Charlotte and this weird divide through the culture in the city of Charlotte, which in one sense is very prosperous. It feels like Austin in some ways. You know, it's this very kind of up and coming, affluent, highly educated, cosmopolitan place. And then, you know, boom, just on the other side of the freeway, it turns into, you know, something that feels a lot like Detroit or the worst parts of Philadelphia. So needless to say, I was not invited to go back to the conventions this year because I just spent the last ones interviewing hookers and drug dealers, which I suppose you don't actually have to go to a convention to do that. You can do that all places.
Well, that sort of leads into my next question, I guess. Do you find that you need a certain environment to work, or do you prefer a certain environment to actually to work within? Like, okay, so you go out and you interview the hookers and the homeless people and the Appalachian people and all that, but then do you have to retreat like to your fortress of solitude to bang out your column? Or
One of the nice things about having been in the daily newspaper business pretty much my whole life is that, you know, I can sit down and write 1,000 words. If I got to sit down and write 1,000 words, if I've got 20 minutes, I can do it in 20 minutes. If I got 2 hours, I can do it in 2 hours. I mean, you're going to get different pieces if I got 20 minutes versus 2 hours, but I can knock that out, you know, as fast as I have to. It's just, if you're, you know, if you're someone who's been an Olympic runner your whole life, this is just run around the block. You know, you can run around the block, you know how to do it. So, you know, I write all sorts of places. I write in my car sometimes if I don't have any place to go. I write a lot in, if I'm traveling, you know, in Starbucks and airport lounges and airplanes and that sort of thing. Here in Houston, where I live, I work from home. I don't have an office here. So that's nice and that's pleasant, although I do miss being in New York because there's the, you know, that kind of cross-pollination of being in an office full of other writers and other people to talk to about things and get ideas and stuff. So I might be a little too isolated here, although I'll go back to the New York office as often as I can. But no, I can write in a crowded, loud place if I need to. Trying to think if there's a particular place that really affects me that way. Not really that much. If I'm writing a really long piece, like when I'm working on books and things like that, that's pretty much always done at home.
Mm-hmm.
Because I can, you know, turn everything off and close the door and turn my phone off and, you know, put the do not disturb sign on the door or whatever and do that. I have been known to, you know, go to some town where I don't know anybody or have anything to do and check myself into a hotel if I've got something I need to sit down and write for, you know, 5 days in a row and not do anything else. I've done that occasionally on longer pieces that I've worked on.
So if you were going to, like, what let's talk about some advice maybe you can impart to others, because you talked before about there's people who say they want to be writers and they're the ones that want to go to, like, you know, they want to go and they want to have lunch with their agent and they want to do book signings. But let's talk a moment about the people who actually want to go through that grind. If there is any kind of an advice you can impart to somebody who wants to do that, what would some of that be?
Sure. Well, the first thing is there are no book tours anymore. You need to know that there really aren't book tours anymore. People think about book tours and going on book tours. I've written a whole bunch of, well, not a whole bunch of books, but a few books. There's never even been talk of doing a book tour. You know, the thing about writing is, well, there are a couple things. You as a writer, unless you're a really, really interesting person, the way Bill was an interesting person or the way Hunter Thompson was an interesting person, you don't necessarily want to put yourself in the middle of it. It's not really something that's about you so much. But at the same time, you have to answer the question, well, why should I spend $25 and 15 to 40 hours of my life on this book you've written? You know, why is it that you of all people have something to say? And if you ever go through the depressing business of looking at actual book sales and seeing what books sell, not what's on the New York Times bestseller list, because that's a different sort of thing, but the actual volume in dollars of books that sell every year, they're mostly celebrity memoirs and diet books. So that's what mm-hmm. that's what people are really, really looking for on that. If you're looking at the best selling literary authors, the best selling novelists, or the best selling people who do the sort of books that I do, of political books and policy books, we're nowhere near usually the top 100 or top 200 or anything like that. We're way down there. So, you know, you need to think about why it is you're writing this thing you're writing, whether it's a novel or a book about an issue. If it's a book about an issue, you know, a nonfiction piece, there's always the question of why you, because, you know, you're probably not that much of an expert on the thing you're writing about, at least compared to somewhere in the world, there's an academic expert with a PhD who has made some subset of this issue his entire life's work and knows just everything about it. And this guy will never write a book that anybody reads because it's going to be unreadable and boring. Or he'll write it and seven people who are his graduate students will read it and then follow up on his work over the years, which is how academic work gets done. So there's that. You know, people worry too much about money and all that. We're talking about, you know, how you make a living, and we can maybe talk about that more in a minute if you want. But it's really an unpredictable thing. Sometimes books will do really well. Sometimes they won't. There's no way to know in advance whether they will or not. Book publishers certainly don't know this. If you look at the way book publishers operate, you know, they operate on sort of a black swan portfolio model where they buy a whole bunch of stuff and publish it, knowing that most of it's not going to do very well, that close to half of it will lose money. some smaller part will just about break even or make a small profit. And then there'll be some small percentage of that that does really, really well that are the big blockbusters that make it worth doing that. They would just buy those if they knew how to pick them, but nobody knows how to pick them. So they publish a whole lot of stuff, which is good for me because I don't write best-selling blockbusters by any stretch of the imagination so far.
But what about like, okay, so that's like, that's for novels or books, but what about something more along the lines of, you know, what, you know, I do sometimes, what you do, if you're just going to write articles.
Yeah, well, I tell young people, I talk to them about journalism a lot, obviously, because I used to teach, and I do a lot of talks on college campuses and things like that. And the first thing I always recommend to people is go be a reporter. You know, learn something about something. You're a lot better off going to Philadelphia and working for the Philadelphia Daily News and working the police beat for 2 or 3 years, I think, and really learning how that world operates from the police department to the criminals to the social environments that are affected by this crime that also cultivate and encourage it in some ways, and really being deep dug into that one world for a couple of years. I think that's far more valuable than going and getting, you know, a master's in journalism at Columbia, whatever a master's in journalism entails. I don't actually know, but I'm ready to dismiss it out of hand. So, you know, a lot of people, because being a, you know, quote unquote pundit, someone who used to live in India, the word pundit kind of creeps me out, but because I don't really think we were wise men for the most part. But the idea of having a certain brand of opinions for a living, you know, being conservative for a living or being liberal for a living is a relatively new phenomenon. And it's a very attractive thing in a lot of ways because, you know, you can make a really nice living on Fox News or MSNBC or that sort of stuff. And you can write, you know, you can edit a really dopey, low quality website. But if you're angry enough about the right things and you can drive a lot of traffic and make a pretty good living, I mean, that's the Breitbart model.
Yeah.
Which, you know, less said about those idiots, the better. But I think that's kind of a bad thing to, even if that's your ultimate goal in life, and I'm not sure that's a good goal in life to have, but even if it is, you still need to know something. You know, unless you're an unusual person who's, you know, really, really attractive, really good on television, really quick-witted, and just a sort of good natural TV person, then just being, well, hi, I'm Bob, and I've got conservative opinions about this isn't really, I mean, there's not much of a reason to listen to you or pay attention to you. Again, some people are real naturals at that stuff, and, you know, they could do whatever. But for most people, things aren't that way. So it is very useful to go out and know something about something. I always encourage people not to major in journalism if they have a school that offers a journalism major, which is a dopey degree to offer to start with, I think. But definitely don't do that. And if you know, if you are a journalism major, you should definitely change it.
You'll be happy to note that when we talked to Betsy, she said much the same thing.
Pretty much the same thing. Yep. Yep.
Yeah, I know. It's I probably yelled that at her a few times, but I don't think she ever had been a journalism major.
No, I don't think she was, but she she had arrived at that same conclusion. And she also had said that, you know, speaking specifically about being a reporter, one of the things to do is to just start reporting, go out and start reporting,
you know,
on a subject, know something about it.
Yeah, you know, people act like it's some obscure, arcane, specialized profession, but it's not. You know, I mean, the idea of getting a journalism degree is a fairly new thing. The idea of newspaper men being people who had college degrees is a fairly new development too. For most of the history of that industry, that wasn't the case. They were kind of blue collar. You know, being curious about the way the world works and going out and asking people about it and trying to figure it out and then writing for other people about it in a way that's accessible and entertaining is actually a pretty straightforward proposition. Mm-hmm. And that's why college newspapers and things like that are so useful, because not everyone can write. Some people just don't have a talent for it. Some people don't have the ear for language or the real love of crafting prose. And, you know, you'll figure that out pretty quickly. If you work at your college newspaper for a couple of years, that's just not what you're good at. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like, you know, it's like playing sports. You know, you could take a class in basketball or you could go play basketball. And if you're not very good at basketball, you'll figure it out pretty quickly.
So is writing, would you say, if you have the talent, is writing more about discipline than anything else? Do you just have to settle down and learn the craft and write? And
yeah, well, you're never going to do it if you don't do it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what we say, a necessary but not sufficient condition. I mean, you do have to sit down and write. Some people have really, really fixed schedules. I remember someone talking about John Updike, and he had some really, really specific schedule of writing like 458 words a day or something like that. It was some strange number. This may be apocryphal. I don't know. That is literally true. But, you know, if you can sit down and write 500 words a day, you know, that's a pretty good sized book every year. So even if on top of whatever your regular job is, you can do that. And it's not a terribly difficult thing to do. It's not a huge Herculean task. Then you can get that knocked out. And after a couple of months of writing 500 words a day on something, you'll know, you know, whether it's actually any good. In terms of, you know, the daily stuff, the kind of, you know, internet journalism and that, I mean, this is the golden age for that. I mean, anybody can publish anything and get an audience. So, and again, you can figure out pretty quickly whether you're any good at it, because people will generally tell you. And it's not that they'll tell you you suck, it's just they won't read your stuff. You know, people don't mostly criticize bad writing or criticize bad journalism. They mostly just ignore it,
yeah.
Which is really the most effective form of criticism, of
course.
That's
a good point.
It does sink in eventually, I think, when you just don't get a response to something. So
yeah, the, you know, that's one of the most maddening things about what I do. If I had hair, I would pull it out. So sometimes I'll work on something that, you know, it's a real labor of love that, you know, I polish every, you know, semicolon of, and I think, you know, what I've really done, and we'll publish it and it just sinks without, you know, like a rock thrown into a lake.
Yeah.
Just with barely a ripple. And then sometimes there'll be something that I write in, you know, 25 minutes at the last minute because someone's asked me to, that a million people will read, and it'll be on, you know, radio shows and people talking about it on television and that kind of stuff.
Yes.
And
yeah, that happens. It's weird.
And again, it's just an example of it's hard to say what people are going to respond to. And writers often aren't very good judges of their own writing. You know, Walt Whitman was the great example of this, where he put out 10 or 11 different versions of Leaves of Grass, and he self-published. And every version that he edited of his own work, he made worse. You know, the first version of Leaves of Grass is generally considered the right one. And then Whitman put out a whole bunch of different edits that were just worse and worse and worse and worse. He was a great writer and a terrible judge of his own writing. T.S. Eliot, in some ways, the same way. He had a lot of good editors. And he was a good editor of other people's work, but he wasn't a very good editor of his own work. That's kind of what Ezra Pound did for him. So maybe it's a bit like that, although not to put myself in the company of those writers. You know, occasionally something that I think is just, you know, you know how it is when you've written something you like and you're like, damn, you know, this is the four times a year I write something that I'm really proud
right.
of. About four times a year for me, typically, that I write something where I'm like, you know, pump my fist in the air afterward, good work, Williamson. And then, boom, just...
It falls like flat. Yeah, nobody likes it. Yeah. Neil, I think, has had that experience. I've had that experience. You write something in like a half an hour just to do something because somebody asked for it, or 45 minutes or whatever, and next thing you know, it's all over the place.
Oh, yeah. No. I took 15 minutes once to dash off a crappy little response to a, you know, millennial complaining about her job, you know, and just really just took her to task about it. It ended up on Fox News. I did a bunch of radio spots. Yeah. It was like I'm sitting here. I sweat blood to try to be funny in one of my, you know, regular articles, and then bam, you know, snark fest at the millennial gets a million, whatever.
Yeah.
But so that is a real frustration, I think, for people who really.
Well,
I think...
Maybe one useful lesson from that is that particularly in political writing, we hate to admit this to ourselves, but people don't come to it for the writing. They come to it to have their values reaffirmed.
Mm. Yes.
Or they come to it to see you flay someone they don't like.
Yes. Yes, they do.
The intellectual champion on their behalf against a real or perceived enemy. You can write really badly if you do that stuff. People will read you religiously.
So another quick writer question here. Is writer's block real, or is that just an excuse?
Largely an excuse, I think. I mean, there are people who aren't crazy who I know who talk about this. And, you know, for me, it was always an issue of I didn't have a plan B, really. I didn't have anything to fall back on. So when I was a young writer, reporter, whatever, you know, I had some editor yelling at me over my shoulder, Williamson, give me my copy in 7 minutes or I'm going to fire you. there's no writer's block there. You know, I mean, maybe it's not the best stuff you ever wrote in your life, but, you know, you knock it out. I probably can't say this, never mind, but I had one editor who was a very nice, attractive, young, blonde woman whose name for me was something that we can't say on a family podcast, I guess. But that was my name as far as she was concerned. And, you know, 5:45, she would start yelling at me. And I would turn in my copy and she would delete my lead without reading it because she just assumed I didn't know how to write one. And then she would go and so I'd write jokes in my lead after that and she wouldn't notice. She'd just cut them out. She would go and edit my story, then go back and put a proper lead on it. And that was that. So if you're in the, you know, the daily newspaper business, there's not a whole lot of room for writer's block. And, you know, my first real job out of college was at the Indian Express newspapers in Bombay and Delhi. And, you know, just the backside of the operation there, the press runs and all that, because they publish an English language newspaper, a couple of English language newspapers, and then a bunch of Indian language newspapers. So the daily press run was, you know, millions and millions of copies. So you couldn't be 40 minutes late on something. I mean, just the expense of it was just unthinkable. You know, the presses were going to start rolling when they were going to start rolling, because you had hundreds of people, you know, of compositors and plate makers and pressmen and truck drivers and delivery people and all that on the back end. So you couldn't just, you know, sit around. That was really, I guess, really the last, you know, great days of print in a lot of ways, when print was still the dominant thing and internet journalism was a subsidiary. Now I think it's kind of the other way around.
Do you think print is going to, I mean, we've seen the digital revolution with books, and now I notice, and I'm one of them included, a lot of people now saying that they want to get more paper books. You know, they actually order the physical book rather than getting it on their Kindle. Is there any room for, you know, print journalism to kind of come back into its like glory days, or do you think we're kind of?
I think so. You know, again, well, I mean, I've already told you about my history as an entrepreneur in this business, so maybe apply the proper discount to my prognostications here. But if I were, you know, in the investing business, I would be perfectly happy to be an equity holder in something like the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or the Times of London. That's a big national or international journalistic enterprise. I would also be perfectly happy to own something that's very small and very local. Maybe not a daily newspaper, but a weekly newspaper in a city of 100,000 to 200,000 that covers the school board and police and the city council and local sports and the schools and all that kind of stuff. And I edited those kinds of newspapers for a long time, and they were tremendously profitable. The amount of money that was thrown off by these little publications was surprising, how profitable they were. Where I would be afraid is if I were in that big space in between. You know, the New York Times, I think, is probably great. Your local community newspaper is probably great in the long term. But if I were something like the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, mm-hmm. or the Miami Herald, mm-hmm. or, you know, I mean, the Houston Chronicle here is a pretty good newspaper, but I would be nervous about it, especially if you're in a place that isn't like Boston or Austin or San Francisco, where you've got a real kind of reading culture. You know, people in cities like Houston and Atlanta and Miami drive everywhere, so they're not on trains.
Exactly, yeah.
Or buses or anything like that. You don't have any kind of, you know, pedestrian culture where people are going to walk past a newsstand and pick up a newspaper. So you've got people who are going to subscribe, which means, you know, older people who are homeowners who are fixed in place, and there are just, you know, kind of fewer of those households over time. So mm-hmm. I think those print publications in the middle are going to get squeezed, although they'll probably survive reasonably well as locally focused internet alternatives.
Yeah, I've been worried about that with my local, the Virginian Pilot. which is, I like it. It's a good paper. I like holding a newspaper. You know, I like the tactile sensation of that, turning the pages. You know, the few times that they've consented to actually print something I send them, it's actually, I don't know if this is true for anyone else, but seeing your name in print on a piece of paper, it feels very different from seeing it as a byline on an internet article. I don't know. Is that something that you see as well, or?
Yeah, and I still find it satisfying. National Review sometimes will sell pieces that I've written to other publications.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like the Dallas Morning News will sometimes say, sure, hey, we like this piece, can we reprint this, or some other newspaper? And I often don't know about this until after the fact. And so every now and then I will accidentally encounter myself somewhere, and that's always kind of fun.
And it's weird because it doesn't really make too much sense, because if you think about like raw numbers, more eyeballs are probably on an internet version of the article than on the newspaper. But it just feels.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, National Review, the magazine, you know, our circulation fluctuates. But in a, you know, in a good period, we're, you know, just under 200,000, something like that. So 185,000, maybe 165,000, depending. Which is a very, very healthy number for a magazine of our sort. It's much, much bigger than any of our near competitors. But the website is millions of people during that same period of time, millions of unique viewers. So, you know, National Review, the website, in terms of readership, is as big or bigger than what the print New York Times was in what they thought of as of its golden age.
Mm-hmm.
You know, millions and millions of people going there. So it is nice to be able to reach that audience. The downside is that people pay less attention to it. They flip through stories more quickly. People don't finish newspaper stories for the most part, but they read even less deeply into web stories.
Absolutely.
So yeah. Reader behavior is very different between the two media. And so that's something you have to keep in mind, especially for someone like me who tends to write 5,000 word pieces. just, you know, it's pretty much me and my girlfriend and, you know, when she was still alive, my mom. Mm-hmm. That's like all. That's who's going to read that online. No one else is reading those 5,000 words. My editor might.
Might.
He will. Although he'll tell me to cut half of them.
Tell us a little bit about these short books that you have written, the broadsides. How do you approach something like that? Because it's obviously. It's not an article. It's not a full size book. You know, this is like 48 to 60 pages. And so what's that experience like?
Oh, those are great. So the New Criterion and Encounter books are both edited by Roger Kimball, who's a dear friend of mine and a great guy. And, you know, I became a theater critic when Roger called me out of the blue. I hardly knew the guy. I'd spoken to him once on a train because we both lived in Connecticut. And we would take the same train home sometimes. But I didn't know Roger, and he just called me and asked me if I wanted to write the theater column. And I was like, is this the theater column that Mark Stein used to write? Because that's, you know, it's pretty big shoes to jump into. But he had read my stuff and kind of liked it and invited me to do that. And the broadsides have basically worked the same way, where maybe I've written about something or talked about something. He said, yeah, we should do a broadside on that. And I'll sit down and, you know, those I often write in one or two sittings. There'll be a lot of reading and sort of note-taking that goes into it. But when it's actually time to sit down and write it, you know, I'll sit down at 8 o'clock in the morning and finish it up that afternoon typically. So that sort of thing I can write really pretty quickly because they're, you know, 5,000 to 10,000 words, something like that. So it's like a long magazine piece.
Oh, okay.
But they're fun because, you know, you can get a little more broad-ranging. So I wrote one about the history of the welfare state, one about Detroit, one about Trump. And the Trump thing was funny because we kept going back and forth. And Roger was like, I'm not sure that we should publish this. I mean, surely he's not going to be in the race 3 weeks from now.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, I think a lot of us believe the same thing.
I made the same error there. But so Kevin, we're going to wrap up here pretty soon. I got one more question for you. And actually, then we have another more important question. But So just one final little piece of advice maybe for any aspiring writers who are listening. Rejection is going to be part of your life at some point if you're a writer. How do you what's the best way to do that? How should you treat rejection? How should you cope with it? You know, how should you respond to it?
Well, you know, you have to have a pretty strong ego to write or talk for a living to start with, because you're assuming that people care about what you want to say. But, you know, again, I would go back and if you look at some really successful, admirable American writers, and again, I like to take the case of Updike, not because he's necessarily my favorite. He's not. But someone who was both commercially successful, but also had a great deal of literary standing. If you go back and look at how many books he sold over the course of his life, any given John Updike novel or collection, you know, it's not very big numbers. So 99.5% of American households didn't give a damn what John Updike had to say about anything. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you're going to get the same numbers, probably. And that's going to include agents and publishers and things like that. But you'll, you know, eventually figure out if you're actually any good at something. You know, as a free market guy, as a libertarian, I really do sincerely believe that markets actually are pretty good at sorting things out. And sometimes it takes a while. But no, people eventually will be able to connect. If you're creating something of value, they can connect it with the people who will find and appreciate that value. And it's easier now than it was because you don't actually have to print books.
The barriers to entry are much lower. It's true.
They're non-existent.
Yeah.
Really? You said you had one last question.
We do have one last question. And this one is basically our only gotcha question that we ask our guests. And it's a matter of some cultural importance. You may have seen it referenced. It's a sort of an eternal battle between competing factions in the United States. And Jay and I disagree on this question, but we want you to know that however you choose to answer it, it will not affect our opinion of you in the slightest bit. We will still hold you in the same esteem. So, Jay?
Question is Die Hard a Christmas movie?
I haven't seen it. I've seen all the clips with Snape, but I've never actually watched that movie. You know, I didn't own a television until I was 40 years old, and I don't go to a lot of movies and things. I was very much a young fogey, so I'm the most culturally insulated person who's not actually from an upper class background that you'll ever meet.
That is astounding. That Jay, is. should we resurrect the Frank V. Dean question?
We could do that one. We could do that one.
Okay, Kevin, help us out. Frank Sinatra or Dean Martin?
Oh gosh, it's
this one is Frank's, tough. Frank,
well, it's not tough. It's not tough for me. I'm just trying to think of how to explain myself on it. Frank Sinatra would be the canonical choice, but I'm just more of a Dean Martin fan. Mm-hmm. In the same way that I think I've talked to Jay Norlinger about this sometimes. I sometimes fear that I have bad taste in music because I tend to like stuff that isn't subtle. So in classical music, you know, I like Wagner and Bach and this sort of, big melodies, kind of mathematical sort of sounding stuff. Whereas Schubert, I just don't get, and Brahms, I just don't get. I think they're too refined for me. And Dean Martin is sort of the, if you boil down that era of, he's Italian-American. Likes to drink, likes his martinis. I lived in Vegas for a while, so I'm kind of that world appeals to me to some extent. Dean Martin was very much that, whereas, maybe Frank Sinatra is the platonic ideal of the saloon singer, but for some reason just doesn't work for me. So I'm team Dean Martin on that.
Yes. Yes. Yes, that was the correct answer.
Yeah,
I probably like Sammy Davis a little bit. Man had a huge voice, really, for such a small man.
True,
sure did.
Really did.
Sure
really
did.
Well, thank you so much for joining us and discussing writing with us. And actually, you have your own podcast, isn't that right?
Charlie and I do. It's called Mad Dogs and Englishmen. And we try to do it at least once a week, although often we are not entirely successful in doing that. So it's good to have two people with very different accents on a podcast. Easy to tell us apart. No one ever mistakes me for Charles.
But it is a very fine podcast, very fun to listen to. So, but we hope to have you back on our show sometime.
Well, thanks for letting me pompously hold forth, as writers like to do sometimes.
It was excellent. It was everything we hoped for.
It was. Kevin Lameson, everyone. So all right. Again, if you like this show, go out there, subscribe, tell your friends about it, and we'll see you next time here on the Fifth Estate.